We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, and thank you so much for being so patient. I am so glad we're finally starting season three. Some of my favorite episodes are coming up this season, so I'm excited for you to hear them. Okay, we've got a big Patreon perk starting right now, right this second, okay? So listen up. If you sign up at the Obsessed Fan level between now and the end of June, so you've got a couple of weeks, I will send you a printed copy of your favorite episode of the podcast, signed and inscribed to you from me, okay? So when you sign up at Patreon, just shoot me a note through Patreon and tell me what you want, and I'll get you set up. And this is for fans anywhere in the world, okay? I will find you. And I will get you a signed and inscribed episode, okay? A printed episode of your choice, whichever one you want. Now, just to remind you, on Patreon, at the Obsessed Fan level, you're not only supporting the show and the people who make it, although you are doing that, you're getting ad-free episodes on the day of release, plus a bonus episode every single month. And don't forget, a portion of your donation goes to Write Girl, a creative writing and mentoring organization that promotes creativity, critical thinking, and leadership skills to empower teen girls and gender expansive youth. So, if you've been thinking about joining Patreon and you just weren't sure, now's the time. Okay, now, as for the live shows, things are falling into place. I want to thank Timothy for the help in Dallas and Janice for the help in Long Island, which sounds like it's going to happen, and it's going to be really fun. It's going to be an extra special show, okay? And there'll be more details on these shows coming soon. Now, if you've reached out about cities that we've said we're definitely coming to, I've been in touch with you. If you've reached out about cities we haven't officially talked about yet, I'm saving that information, and I'll get in touch with you guys soon, all right? But for now, if any of you have, let's see, we're looking at Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia. Okay, so if any of you have connections or ideas for places that we could use for the live show that are fun, free, or as close to free as possible, and haunted, or as close to haunted as possible, let me know, okay? And you guys know how to reach out. You reach me at richard@richardhaddamsparanormalbookshelf.com. There's a link at the website, or just shoot me an email at richard@richardhaddamsparanormalbookshelf.com. Okay. In the words of my buddy Badlands Chugs, enough talk. Here we go. Communion by Whitley Strieber, Part 1. Communion by Whitley Strieber, Beech Tree Books, William Morrow, 1987, is unique among abductee literature in that it is actual literature. Strieber is a wonderful writer and was already very successful as a novelist when Communion was published. By that time, I'd already read four of his books, The Wolfen and the Hunger in high school, and War Day and Nature's End in college. But when I saw Communion in bookstores, I didn't buy it. I know this might sound hard to believe, but at the time, it just didn't interest me. The only explanation I can think of is that, at that time, I was throwing myself at what I then considered real life pretty hard. Writing TV scripts and trying to sell them, I was being my version of a hard-headed pragmatist about everything. There was a keen sense of purpose inside me all the time. There was no time for ruminating on the supernatural. Other people could waste their time. I had goals to achieve. I was the shark in the kiddie pool, the pickpocket at Disneyland. I was working while everyone else was having fun. When Communion was published in February 1987, abductee narratives were not common. For the wider public, this was the first one since Raymond Fowler's The Andreessen Affair in 1982, and before that, John G. Fuller's The Interrupted Journey. But Communion was different. Whitley Strieber's book was a first-hand account. Here was a well-known author outing himself as an abductee. The publication of Communion landed like a bomb. It topped the bestseller list for 6 months. It generated a huge amount of publicity, and the masterstroke of its marketing was undeniably the illustration of the alien on the cover of the book. In today's parlance, it was extremely triggering. People saw it, and it was as if a secret part of their own lives had suddenly been revealed to them. There were people who had no conscious recollection of their own abductions until they saw the cover of Communion. Strieber's book begins with his conscious recollections of being abducted by intelligent non-human beings on the night of December 26, 1985. The memories surface slowly and piecemeal, like fragments of a nightmare during the first 2 weeks of January 1986. As they came into focus, Strieber says, quote, "I just about exploded with terror and utter disbelief. I thought that I had lost my mind. I thought quietly and calmly, you may be going mad, or you may have a brain tumor. You've got to find out which it is and take whatever steps are necessary. And then I rested my head on the desk and quite frankly cried." As his recollections continue, Whitley finds himself reading Jenny Randall's book, Science and the UFOs. Basil Blackwell, Oxford, 1985. The book was a serendipitously odd Christmas present from his brother. Whitley had never expressed any interest in UFOs. But now, something about the book bothered and intrigued him. When he got toward the end, he reached a section that includes a, quote, "archetypal abduction experience." Whitley says, quote, "I was shocked. I was lying in bed at the time, and I just stared and stared at the words. My first reaction was to slam the book closed as if it contained a coiled snake. They were talking about people who think they've been taken aboard spaceships by aliens, and I seem to be such a person. my blood went cold. Nobody must ever, ever know about this, not even my wife, Anne. A few mornings later, I was sitting at my desk when things just seemed to cave in on me. Wave after wave of sorrow passed over me. I just could not bear this memory, and I could not get rid of it. What on earth were those things? What had they done to me? I looked at the window with hunger. I wanted to jump. I wanted to die. Okay. So here's what happened to Whitley Strieber on the night of December 26th, 1985. Here are the events that, as he became aware of them, made him actually consider killing himself. He's sound asleep when he suddenly jolts awake to a, quote, whooshing, swirling sound in the downstairs living room of his mountain cabin. It sounded as if, quote, a large number of people were moving rapidly around in the room. As the noise continues, he does something even he can't explain. He begins to settle back into bed. This odd paranormal apathy is something I've talked about with Scott and Forrest on the Astonishing Legends podcast many times, and Whitley himself identifies this inappropriate response as something that recurs throughout his experiences. Quote, if something is strange enough, the reaction is very different from what one would think. The mind seems to tune it out, as if by some sort of instinct. Before he's quite settled back, he notices something. His open bedroom door is slowly moving closed. Now he's really awake and scared. And that's when he sees a small, compact figure lean out and peer at him from behind the edge of the door. Whitley describes it like this, quote, it had a smooth, rounded hat on with an odd, sharp rim that jutted out easily 4 inches on the side I could see. I saw two dark holes for eyes and a black, downturning line of a mouth that became the letter O. From shoulder to midriff was the visible third of a square plate etched with concentric circles. At the time, I thought it looked like some sort of breastplate or even an armored vest. Beneath it was a rectangular appliance of the same type which covered the lower waist to just above the knees. I sat there, frightened, unable or unwilling to deal with what I was observing. The next thing I knew, the figure came rushing into the room. Here's where his memory goes blank for a moment. The next thing he knows, he's being moved face up out of his bedroom. He is naked and he is paralyzed. He wants desperately to move under his own volition, but he can't. He is in a state of panic. Another mental jump cut, and now he is outside, sitting in a small depression in the woods, like a hole. To his left is a creature in a gray tan bodysuit sitting on the ground with its knees drawn up and its hands clasped around them like a child. For some reason, he gets the distinct impression that this figure is female. To his right is another figure that he is only peripherally aware of. It seems to move very quickly and is, quote, working busily at something that seems to have to do with the right side of my head. Whitley is now aware of tree branches moving past his face, and when he looks down, he can see the forest falling away beneath him. His view is suddenly obscured by a section of gray flooring that seems to close beneath him like a camera's iris. When he looks around the room that he is in, he makes an extremely uncommon observation that I've never heard in any other UFO story. He describes the room he is in as messy. Quote, I had an impression that it was a messy living space. Across the room to my right, some clothing was thrown on the floor. As a matter of fact, the thought even crossed my mind that the place was actually dirty. He now describes his emotions as, quote, entirely given over to extreme dread. The fear was so powerful that it seemed to make my personality completely evaporate. Whitley ceased to exist. What was left was a body in a state of rough fear so great that it swept about me like a thick, suffocating curtain, turning paralysis into a condition that seemed close to death. I do not think that my ordinary humanity survived the transition to this little room. I died, and a wild animal appeared in my place. I had the thought I was being taken away and remembered my family. An acute, gnawing feeling of being in a trap overcame me. It was a truly awful sensation, accompanied as it was by the sense that I was absolutely helpless in the hands of these strange creatures. For the first time, one of the creatures speaks, and in yet another unique detail, it speaks in a voice he can clearly hear outside his head, not telepathically, the way almost every other human-alien conversation I've ever read about is reported. Its voice has a subtle electronic tone and a strangely Midwestern accent, and it asks, "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" In my own visits to the Midwest, I am always asked this question, at least once. If you think the alien's question is odd, wait till you hear Whitley's answer. Quote, "You could let me smell you," he says. The alien to his right says,
"Oh, okay, I can do that,"
and places his hand on Whitley's face. Whitley describes the smell as the scent of cardboard, as if the sleeve of the coverall were made of some substance like paper. The hand itself had a faint but distinctly organic sourness in its odor. It was not a human smell, but it was unmistakably the smell of something alive. There was a subtle overtone that seemed a little like cinnamon. For Whitley, it is this sensory moment that stands out as the most convincing aspect of the whole memory. One of the creatures holds up a box and slides it open so that Whitley can see an extremely thin, shiny needle, and he is told that they are going to insert it into his brain. "If I'd been afraid before," he says, "I now became quite simply crazed with terror." He begs them not to do it, but he feels an odd sensation at the base of his skull behind his right ear. There is a sudden bang and a flash, and it is clear they have just done exactly what they said they would do. Next, they move him into a room like a small operating theater. He's once again paralyzed and is being carried, quote, "as if I were being passed along by a row of insects." When they arrive, he is placed on a table. They show him a foot-long object, gray and scaly, and insert it into his rectum. Quote, "It seemed to swarm into me," he says, "as if it had a life of its own. I had the impression I was being raped, and for the first time, I felt anger." The instrument is removed, and then one of the creatures makes a small incision in his right forefinger that elicits no pain, and that is where the memories of the event come to an end. In the morning, his only conscious memory, besides a vague feeling of unease, is that at some point in the night, he looked out his window and saw a large owl staring back at him. He also has a small cut on his right forefinger, and several days later, he finds a small wound at the base of his skull, behind his right ear. As these memories surfaced and Whitley felt his psyche imploding, he knew what he had to do. What he did was contact Bud Hopkins, a UFO researcher who had been mentioned in Jenny Randall's book. Quote, "I called Bud Hopkins. He answered the phone and listened to my story for a few minutes. I thought I would wither away with embarrassment telling it, but he soon interrupted me. Can I come over, like right now?" It turned out his place in the city was a 10-minute walk from mine. Later, as I sat there in that man's living room, listening to him tell me that I wasn't alone, that others have gone through very much the same thing, the tears rolled down my cheeks, and I went from wanting to hide it all to wanting to understand it. As he's about to leave Bud's apartment, two things happen. First, they discuss hypnosis as a means to retrieve more details of the December 26th encounter, and Whitley indicates this is something he would like to try. Second, Bud happens to ask if Whitley remembers any other times in his past when something strange has happened. Whitley's about to say no, when out of nowhere, he remembers a night the previous October when, as he puts it, quote, "I seem to remember a night the house burned down, but it didn't burn down." Hopkins suggests that something might have happened in October that involved the same forces that visited Whitley in December. While frightening, something about this notion is also encouraging to Whitley, because on that particular night, there were house guests at the cabin, witnesses. Perhaps their recollections of what happened that night could shed light on what Whitley experienced 2 months later. For the first time in weeks, he feels confident that all of this might have a rational explanation. That feeling doesn't last very long. The year I graduated college did not go as planned. My plan was I wouldn't even graduate. I'd sell a TV script, be hired onto the staff of some show, drop out of college, and that'd be that. I mean, who needs a diploma from USC Film School if I've already got a job in Hollywood? By the way, I was right. No one in Hollywood has ever had more than a vague interest in where I went to college, or even if I went to college. But my point is, back then, college was just something I was doing while trying to sell TV scripts. The only problem was, I didn't sell any. I'd spent 5 solid years from the time I was a junior in high school writing spec scripts for the A-Team, Riptide, Hardcastle and McCormick, Simon and Simon, Remington Steele, The Equalizer, Newhart, Family Ties, Cheers, but so far nothing had sold. So as graduation day approached, it became clear that I wasn't going to step directly from school into a job writing television. I know how it sounds. What did I expect? A lot, that's what. There was no tolerance in my body for failure and no patience at all. Did I really think Hollywood was just going to roll out the red carpet for me? You bet I did. So as foolish as it might seem, I was incredibly demoralized when I reached the end of my formal education and was still no closer to my dream job than I'd been 5 years earlier. But really, it was worse than that. After 5 years of trying and failing to sell my scripts, I was running low on youthful enthusiasm. And my USC film school experience had done nothing to bolster my belief in myself. The mostly embittered professors felt it was their duty to beat the hope out of your soul for your own good. In fact, they seemed to relish their position of power, for some the only power they ever had, as a way to transfer their own experiences of failure and disappointment onto others, the students, whose hope and optimism they saw as a final galling insult to their own dead and buried dreams. So with little hope or optimism, I staggered out into the adult world in the summer of 1988. My film school friend Michael Grodner asked what my plans were after graduation, if I planned to move out, and did I want to find a place together. I didn't know Grodner super well, but I did know this. He was the funniest person I'd ever met. Pretty much everything he said made me laugh. He was from New York, he smoked, and he had a weird sense of humor that made fun of everybody in the world, but mostly himself. His idea came as a total surprise. It hadn't even occurred to me that I was allowed to move out. So I took him up on the idea immediately. My parents didn't take it well. They were actually shocked. Why would I want to move out? Was it something they'd done? I was in the delicious position of battling them with pure, normal logic. I graduated college. It was time for me to try to make it on my own. So I was moving out. I wanted to see if I could survive on my own. This was totally on brand for me. There was not much they could say. Graduation had been the first week of May, and I was out by June 1st. Grodner and I moved into a back house apartment on the top of a hill in Silver Lake on a street called Lafayette Park Place. When we went through it the first time, choosing who would have which bedroom, Grodner chose the smaller one toward the back. "This is definitely the moodier room," he said, as if that was the best selling point. Then he suddenly opened the window a crack and jammed his mouth against the opening, gasping for air. That summer, I had 2 jobs. I was a waiter at a restaurant in Pasadena, on the corner of Colorado Boulevard and Fair Oaks called Dodsworth. And I taught comedy traffic school. If you don't know what comedy traffic school is, I don't have time to explain it to you now. That's for another podcast. As far as Dodsworth is concerned, it was a fancy supper club kind of place with a jazz band every night. We even got some celebrities. One night, I had the honor of urinating next to Paul Simon. It was exhilarating to be on my own, and the sense of freedom was incredible. I was very happy. For about 3 months. But a weird thing happens that first summer out of college. It ends. And everything in your body tells you that vacation is over and it's time to go back to school. After all, that's what you've done pretty much every September for your entire life. But now there's no school to go back to. And suddenly you're hit with the realization that life is no longer going to arrange your future for you. If I wasn't careful, I would be working at Dodsworth and teaching traffic school for the rest of my life. By October, the reality of my life was very clear. I was a normal person. Common. A basic bitch. As much as I had tried to be exceptional, to transcend my high school and college peers, my stack of unsold TV scripts hadn't done me any good. So what should I do? Maybe it was time to try writing a feature film. That was how most people broke into the film business in those days, not with a TV pilot, but with a movie. I didn't really have an idea, but I didn't let that stop me. I lurched forward with a script called Crookbook, which was about a con man who hires a private detective for some reason, and at the end there's a big showdown at a neo-Nazi training camp in Idaho. It was an action comedy, and except for the fact that there was no action and it wasn't funny, I think it really stank. Folks, this endeavor took me a year. The script was truly awful, and by the end of that year, I was thoroughly convinced that whatever talent I thought I had was a complete illusion. You see, I have always lived by a very simple, brutal theory. The world will tell you if you have talent. If you're writing but not selling, you don't have talent. A minus B equals C. And for me, the math was becoming inescapable. I wasn't selling anything. Even worse, I wasn't liking what I was writing. And this was very bad news indeed, because there really wasn't any other way for me to imagine my life. I had to be successful at this one thing. And if I wasn't, well, that was it for me. I had no plan B. I felt like I had something to offer. I felt like I had talent, but the world kept telling me otherwise. And now, for the first time, so did my gut. There was a piece missing. There had to be. But until I found it, I was dead in the water. It was around this time that a slippery thought formed in my brain. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my writing is good. I just don't know it. Maybe all I have to do is keep cranking out pages, don't waste time questioning the quality, and somehow, magically, I'll accidentally write something that someone wants to buy. You might think this would be a productive way to bypass the editor brain and tap into pure creativity, but for me, it just led to a bunch of half-written scripts. All of them lazy and meandering and poorly thought out. Screenwriting is an exact and unforgiving art form. It works best with a sniper rifle, not a shotgun. You really have to know what you're doing. But no one at USC had ever sat me down and explained to me how to write a film script, or any other kind of a script for that matter, and I mean this literally. In my 2 years of film production classes at USC, there was not a single class that focused on the basics of screenwriting. So I ended up spending a ton of time and energy on doomed efforts, knowing they were doomed, but not knowing why. I was like a bird trapped in a house, slamming into every window, praying that it was a way out. I mean, it must be, right? There's sky out there. But I kept beating my brains in until finally my pain and fear and confusion became so great that I retreated into a corner, trembling, too terrified to make a move in any direction. For me, the process went on well into the spring of 1990, 2 full years after college graduation. That's when I picked up Communion. How could I have known how much this story of terror, confusion, and helplessness would resonate with me? Reading Communion was like rubbing salt on a psychic wound. Forget salt, this was sulfuric acid. Experiencing Whitley Strieber's suffering was a glorious self-injury. It hurt, but that was okay. I recognized the pain and I deserved it. This was a very dark time for me. And deep down, I had the compulsion to share my feelings of fear and hopelessness with someone who would truly understand. Luckily, I had just the guy, my friend Matt Reeves. We'd spent most of our time at USC Film School in a swirling vortex of fear and depression, and since graduation, nothing had really changed. Every day, we put on the hair shirt of our unrealized ambitions and divided our time between trying to figure out how to become successful and comforting ourselves with food and dark humor until the world decided our fate. I have one very clear memory of a night in March of 1990. It was one of my last nights in the apartment I shared with Grodner. He was visiting his family in New York, so I had the place to myself. I was reading Communion and becoming consumed with paranoia and despair. So I called Matt to tell him all about it. He hadn't read the book, so I was able to lead him through some of the more lurid parts, pulling him on board my train of fear. And of course, I was telling him that the first thing the alien said to Whitley once he was aboard their craft was,
"What can we do to make you stop screaming?"
We were losing our minds at how terrifying that sentence was, and expressing that terror by laughing our heads off because that was the only defense we had. As we were laughing, something very strange started to happen. The lights in my apartment slowly started to fade. It wasn't a blackout. It was as if all the lights were on a dimmer switch and it was slowly being turned down. I can't explain how disturbing this was. I mean, a blackout is a blackout. We all know what that's like. But this, was this even a thing? I tried explaining to Matt what was happening and he just kept calmly saying, "Yes, you know what's happening. It's them. What can I do to make you stop screaming?" The lights kept slowly dimming, then brightening, then dimming again. It was the first and last time anything like that happened there or anywhere else I've ever lived. We both took it as a sign of something. It had been a while since we'd talked, and even longer since we'd seen each other, so we made a plan to get together. And it was about a week later, while we were hanging out at his house watching The King of Comedy, when he said, "We should write a movie together." To me, the implications of the alien abduction scenario are at best extremely demoralizing and at worst psychologically obliterating. Nobody wants to believe that their autonomy can be stripped away from them at any moment. It's terrible to think about this happening at the hands of other humans, much less an entire race of beings whose very existence reduces the stature of humanity to little more than livestock. It is so horrible to seriously consider the reality of alien abduction that we as a society almost universally don't. It is joked about. It is dismissed out of hand. Mostly it's ignored. I'm kind of stuck here because while I don't think Whitley Strieber is lying or necessarily mistaken about the nature of his experiences, I take the rather cowardly position of, as long as it's not happening to me, I'm not going to think about it too hard. Or no, that's not that exactly, because I do think about it hard, but I think about it in an academic way, like a person who writes detailed histories of war but has never stepped onto the battlefield. I imagine what it must be like, up to a point. Then I stop and get off the roller coaster, if you will, and go relax in the shade with a cold Diet Coke. If one is a complete and total skeptic, I would guess that reading Communion would be in a way like reading a mystery novel where the mystery is Whitley lying or just mentally ill? The generous conclusion in this case is that he is mentally ill. He is innocently struggling with a mental illness we have not clearly diagnosed and don't yet fully understand. This reading is very safe because it allows us to be sympathetic with Whitley Strieber and at the same time feel superior to him. We understand he's crazy even if he does not. But this reading is problematic because Whitley also suspects he's imagining the whole thing. In fact, he's hoping he is. Much in the same way one might ignore or rationalize away physical symptoms of a suspected disease before finally going to a doctor and having your worst fears confirmed. Prompted by Bud Hopkins, Whitley writes down everything he can consciously remember about the night of October 4th, 1985, the night he says, quote, "the house burned down, but it didn't burn down." At the cabin that night are Whitley, his wife Anne, their son, and two house guests, author Anne Gottlieb and author and actor Jacques Sandalescu. Whitley remembers being awakened in the middle of the night and seeing a bright blue light creeping up the wall of the bedroom onto the ceiling as if whatever was causing it was slowly moving down in the front yard from above. It occurs to him that the house must be on fire, and then he promptly falls back asleep. Later, he's awakened by a loud bang like a firecracker going off right above the bed. His wife, Anne, cries out, and he hears his son downstairs begin shouting. The outside of the house is now completely illuminated by some unknown source of light. Thinking that the house is still on fire, he tells his wife, Anne, "The roof's on fire. I'll get our son and wake the others." But no sooner has he said these words than the light from outside goes out. Confused, he heads downstairs, checks on his son for a few minutes, then returns to bed and goes to sleep. After writing all this down, Whitley asks his wife if she remembers anything about that night, and is dismayed when she says she remembers being awakened by a loud bang. Apparently, she heard it too. Score one for objective reality. They both heard a bang. But what made the sound? Keep one thing in mind. At this point, Whitley hasn't shared his strange memories about UFOs and aliens with anyone, including his wife. Whitley questions his son. Does he remember anything special about that night? His son says he remembers hearing a loud bang, but then says, quote, "a bunch of people told him it was okay." Whitley asks, what people? His son says, just a bunch of people who were around. Whitley's son knew their house guests and was unlikely to simply refer to them as a bunch of people. Whitley calls Bud Hopkins, who suggests asking his son not about memories, but of dreams. So Whitley does. This is his son's immediate reply. Quote, "I dreamed that a bunch of little doctors took me out on the porch and put me on a cot. I got scared, and they started saying, 'We won't hurt you,' over and over in my head. That is my strangest dream because it was just like it was real. It happened in the middle of another dream when I was dreaming that me and Ezra were on a boat." I find this description so interesting. A lucid, real dream about little doctors inside a regular dream. Next, Whitley calls Jacques Sandalescu. Same question. Do you remember anything special about that night? Here's Jacques' answer, verbatim. Quote, "The light! I was sleeping. All of a sudden, something woke me up. I saw the room was full of light, bright like daylight, not like the moon. I thought we overslept. I could see the bushes outside. I could see the tree trunks. I thought it was about 10 in the morning. I look at my watch. It says it's 4:30. Then I hear you through the door saying, 'It's okay, the light is gone.' So I go back to sleep." Next, Whitley speaks to Anne Gottlieb. She remembers hearing, quote, "a loud explosion." Then she says, quote, "I heard the scurrying of little feet running across your bedroom upstairs. It must have been the cats." Whitley tells her the cats were back at the apartment in Manhattan, not at the cabin. "You're kidding," Annie says. I always just assumed it was the cats. Anyway, I vaguely remember a light. Mostly, I remember the noises. A few minutes after the scurrying, I heard you come downstairs. You said through the door not to worry. And then the next morning, you told me that some people had come down from a spaceship to visit. Now Whitley loses it. What? Annie, I never said any such thing. I would never say anything like that. Annie says, at the time, I thought it must have been some kind of a dream. Whitley is devastated by these answers. He was obviously hoping that everyone had absolutely no memories of anything special at all, but especially no memories that lined up with his own. What actually did happen that night? Whitley decides that hypnosis might be the best way to retrieve whatever memories his conscious mind is not allowing him to access. He contacts Bud Hopkins to set it up, but insists that they use a hypnotist who has no previous involvement with Bud or abductees at all. Hopkins suggests Dr. Donald Klein of the New York State Psychiatric Institute. A few weeks later, a session is scheduled. And it is during this session, conducted on March 1st, 1986, and focused on the events of the night of October 4th, 1985, that Whitley Strieber realizes what he's experiencing might actually have some basis in physical reality. Writing a movie with Matt Reeves sounded like fun. And in the summer of 1990, I was in desperate need of fun. I was miserable. And misery loves company, and what the hell? It's not like I was doing anything else productive. I didn't have much confidence that anything would come of it, but at the time, I didn't have much confidence, period. But then, Matt had just finished his first year of graduate school at USC, and I had just moved in with my girlfriend, Michelle. She knew Matt, knew how talented he was, and was totally on board with us writing a movie. I think she realized how stuck I was and how much I needed something to get me moving forward again. It was the first week of June. I drove out to Santa Monica, where Matt was still living at home with his mom on Princeton Street. It was late afternoon. I couldn't meet earlier in the day because at that time I was working the lunch shift at Almanzor Court, a golf course dining room in Alhambra. By the time I finished my shift, got home, took a shower, and then fought my way across town from Pasadena to his house. It was almost 6 p.m. So, of course, our first order of business was to eat. We went to Subway, and for us, that was luxury. My go-to was the foot-long meatball sub. Dinner at Subway became a routine for us that summer. We'd eat there and then walk down the mini mall a few doors to Heidi's Frogen Yozert. And yes, it was really called that. And if you lived in L.A. in 1990, you know what I'm talking about. It was this routine we developed that summer that taught me, never write on an empty stomach and always give yourself a treat reward first. So, after dinner and dessert, it was finally time to get down to business. What was our movie going to be about? To figure this out, we got back into Matt's car and drove to Blockbuster Video. Blockbuster Video was a place where you could rent a VHS tape of pretty much any movie you could reasonably want to see. That night, we wandered up and down the aisles, getting alternately excited and depressed at the titles we scanned. Taxi Driver, excited. Tango and Cash, depressed. Godfather, excited. Harlem Nights, depressed. We were about to bail and just rent Raiders of the Lost Ark again, when we turned a corner and came across a display shelf with at least 20 boxes, all featuring a high-rise building with flames coming off the roof and the giant face of Bruce Willis staring at us in shock, topped with the words, 40 Stories of Sheer Adventure. We both went quiet and sighed. This was the movie we wish we had written. This was the most perfect action film of all time. This was Die Hard. I remember Matt saying, "Why can't we write a movie like this?" I knew what he meant. Die Hard wasn't the sort of movie you were supposed to write after graduating from USC Film School. You were supposed to write something serious and meaningful, like The Long Walk Home by John Cork or Boys in the Hood by John Singleton. But still, Die Hard, isn't that why you went to the movies? Hell, isn't that why you went to film school? To learn how to render an expertly crafted piece of genre filmmaking? And besides, wouldn't writing Die Hard be fun? Yes, it would. One problem, Jeb Stuart and Steven D'Souza had already written it. But couldn't we write something like it? What would take Die Hard to the next level? One of us said, what about Die Hard on a train? And the other one said, Die Hard at like 100 miles an hour. We got excited. And then we got embarrassed about how excited we were. But there was something about that idea that made a kind of undeniable sense to us. This might be exactly the sort of movie you'd spend 90 summer nights working on, and by the end, have a script that you could sell for $1 million. And in the late 80s and early 90s, that was happening almost every week. Original spec scripts with hooky concepts by first-time writers were getting snapped up by every studio in Hollywood for outrageous sums of money. These sales haunted us. But of course, we also took them as a direct challenge. If other writers could do it, why couldn't we? We went ahead and rented Die Hard. If nothing else, we'd have fun watching it. We went back to his house and sat on the bed and got the movie set up on his VCR. As it started, I saw Matt pick up a yellow legal pad and a pen. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Taking notes," he said. By the time the movie was over, we were convinced of two things. One, Die Hard was the best action movie ever made. And two, the only thing that could possibly make it any better was to put it on a train. Before I left that night, I looked at the yellow legal notepad. Matt had filled almost 20 pages with a scene-by-scene, beat-by-beat breakdown of the entire movie. He had basically handwritten an outline of Die Hard while we were watching it. I didn't realize it at the time, but Matt had just done the most important thing we would ever do in the process of writing our script. He laid bare the structure of the film, and this is what we would refer to again and again as we built our story, a movie similar to but different from Die Hard. As I drove home that night, I was giddy in that way you can only be on day one of a new idea. As I sped down the now empty Santa Monica freeway, I was reliving all the scenes from Die Hard, but in my mind, laid over it like a transparency were images of a train streaking through the Colorado Rockies, people fighting on top of it while a tunnel hurtled toward them, gunfire ripping through suitcases in the baggage car, bad guys getting blasted through windows and out onto the tracks or over the edge of cliffs. There wasn't anything solid yet, no plot or scenes or characters or anything. Just that amazing, expansive feeling of unlimited possibility that is sometimes the only thing that, when you're a writer, can give you the energy to create something out of nothing. Much of what we learn during Whitley Strieber's first hypnotic session is what I call typical alien abduction stuff. But then, because it's happening to Whitley, it gets weirder and more personal. I'll summarize the transcript, which is provided in full in the book. As Whitley is put under and goes back to the night of October 4th, he becomes terrified almost immediately. He actually begins to cry. He sees a bright light coming from outside his bedroom and then becomes aware of a dark shape standing in the corner, staring at him. The creature approaches him. It has a large bald head and huge slanted eyes. It carries a silver-tipped ruler, and when it touches this ruler to Whitley's head, between his eyebrows, just above his nose, he sees images of what seems to be a worldwide nuclear holocaust. All of this falls under the category of typical alien abduction stuff. I don't mean to dismiss any of this. I'm just acknowledging that many, many abduction narratives include these elements. I should probably add that none of this feels typical to Whitley. It feels terrible. In this session, it is noted that when he sees the creature in his bedroom, he screams for 20 seconds. 20 seconds may not sound like much until you're in a room with someone who is screaming in terror for that length of time. Whitley describes it like this, quote, "I cannot recall experiencing at any time in my life such panic as was evoked at this point in hypnosis. My memory was of seeing the creature sweeping across the room and realizing with a feeling that galvanized my whole being that it was something totally unknown to me, glaring at me from right beside my bed in the dead of night. No written words, nothing can convey my feelings at that moment. All I can say is that I relived fear so raw, profound, and large that I would not have thought it possible that such an emotion could exist." As he is witnessing the images of nuclear holocaust, he hears the creature tell him, "That's your home. That's your home. You know why this will happen." After that, he is shown an image of his son in a lush green park. But don't worry, this is bad too. Whitley is convinced this means that his son is dead. He asks the creature if it is the devil. The creature simply tells him, "I won't hurt you." Here's where things get weird. The silver ruler, oh hell, let's just call it a wand, is again placed onto Whitley's forehead. And now, instead of world destruction, he is shown something much more personal. He sees his father in his final moments of life. Whitley has always been told by his mother that his father died peacefully on the couch in his parents' home after a long illness. But what he sees now is quite different. He sees his father lying on the couch, gasping and choking, grabbing at his throat and writhing spasmodically in what looks like pure agony. Does his mother reach out, try to calm his father or comfort him? No, she simply sits staring at him in horror. Whitley is devastated by this, and he asks a very logical question regarding these visions. Quote, "Why would someone come from a flying saucer and evoke that kind of impression in me? What possible reason would they have?" He admits to feelings of ambivalence about his relationship with his father, and when he saw these images, he felt that ambivalence more sharply than he ever had. Quote, "I never felt close to my father. My dad was distant. He was a loving father, but he always held something back, you know? He was from a very reticent generation. Rural Texans were very inward people. I guess I feel a little bit of guilt about that or something." Then he speculates that the visitors may have used the images to evoke feelings within him to find out, quote, how he ticked. And while he acknowledges that some people may put all this down to a deep psychological need to face some difficult and even terrifying material, he knows it's not as simple as that. Because the hypnosis has also made him sure of another thing. The creature in his bedroom was real. He was there, standing beside his bed, as real as life. After about 3 weeks, Michelle called bullshit on me driving out to Santa Monica 4 nights a week. She worked an office job all day, and I was usually gone by the time she got home. We never saw each other. It sucked, but by that point, I knew that Matt and I were onto something, and that what we were doing was important. I also knew it was serious work, but Michelle didn't. As far as she was concerned, I was just hanging out with Matt every night, goofing around. Either way, it was clear something was going to have to change. So we started a new schedule. Monday and Wednesday nights would be at his house, Tuesday and Thursdays would be at mine. We were working on Matt's computer, so he wrapped his Macintosh Plus in towels and carefully belted it into the passenger seat of his Toyota Camry each time he came over. We set ourselves up in my office, a cramped, low-ceilinged room at the back of the small yellow house Michelle and I rented at 1898 Keystone Street in Pasadena. The place was cozy in the winter, but a sweltering box in the summer. And like an idiot, I refused to buy a window unit air conditioner because I thought the misery would motivate me to work harder and sell something, and then we could move out and live in basic human comfort, once I'd earned it. The only pleasure we allowed ourselves during our writing sessions were Klondike bars, and we were only allowed one per night. Michelle's dog, Jack, a Brittany Spaniel, was having a bad time with fleas that summer, and we had been told to bathe him daily in a substance that smelled like it was 90% alcohol and 10% Satan's farts. And our entire house stank of it. This smell is what Matt says he remembers most about working at my house that summer. That and the kid next door, who took a shower every night before bed, and we could hear him every night singing A Whole New World from Aladdin at the top of his lungs. A whole new world! One night we couldn't resist and joined in. Weirdly, it didn't stop him. He seemed to like it. So every Tuesday and Thursday, we became his new backup singers. We worked every night, Monday through Thursday, 6 p.m. to at least midnight, and sometimes as late as 2 in the morning. June and July were spent outlining. And by outlining, I mean outlining every single scene, bits of dialogue, transitions, everything. By the end of July, we felt we were close enough to knowing the whole movie, and our energy was beginning to flag. It was time to call an end to rehearsal and start performing. The following Monday, we began to write actual script pages. The goal was to write 5 pages a day, 20 pages a week. At that rate, we'd have a first draft in 6 weeks. But then something happened. On August 2nd, 1990, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein unleashed a force of 100,000 troops to invade neighboring Kuwait. They overran the country in a matter of hours. Are you sitting down? It was about oil. But to a lot of people in America, it felt like it was the beginning of World War III. I was 23 and Matt had just turned 24. We didn't know a lot about international relations, but we knew almost everything about being worried. So we worried. For about 3 days. But since no one was asking our opinion about world politics, we decided to bury our fear in our work, which was something else we were very good at, and which has served us both well over the years. Matt would sit hunched in front of his Macintosh Plus, and I would sit next to him just over his right shoulder. And here's how it would go. The cursor would blink and blink. And then I would pitch an idea, actually speak out loud the sentence of action or the line of dialogue I thought we should write. Matt wouldn't move. He would just sit there, squinting at the light of the monitor, like he was trying to see through the screen into the computer, looking for something. I'd pitch another idea, and another. Matt would remain frozen. Had he even heard me? Finally, frustrated, I would lean back and sit in silence, impatiently sulking, waiting for Matt to do something. Anything. A minute or two would go by, and then Matt would slowly begin to write something. Now, usually it was a version of something I had said, or maybe a mixture of two things, but reworded in a way I became convinced was just to deny me ownership of the thought. How dare he include his own ideas? How dare he collaborate? After a while, I didn't even care anymore whether what he wrote was his idea, my idea, or someone else's idea. I just wanted him to write something. Why was this taking so long? Why were we constantly going back and rereading what we had just written 2 minutes ago? Why not just blast forward, get a few pages done, and worry about fixing them later? But no, it became apparent to me that Matt would not write a second word until the first word was perfect. No second sentence until the first one was carved in stone. And it was driving me out of my mind. The fact was, I had never actually written with anyone else. And it bugged me that I would have to pitch multiple things before he would write down one of them. Even if the thing he eventually wrote down was an idea of mine, all I could think about were the first 3 or 4 ideas that he had rejected. I began thinking of him as quality control, and not always in a good way. For some reason, I guess I had assumed that once we got down to writing pages, Matt would more or less be simply taking my dictation. But instead, what happened was the opposite. I started to become so in tune with the way he thought, with the way he visualized every single second of the action on screen, and then found a way to articulate it on the page, that my mind began working like his. After a few weeks of writing with Matt, I felt like I was inside his brain, seeing the movie through his eyes and anticipating what he would actually write down and what he wouldn't. I wouldn't have to pitch 5 ideas before his fingers started typing. I could usually get them going by pitch number 2. And once we were really into it, we were completely connected, finishing each other's sentences and sometimes speaking entire lines word for word at the exact same time as he typed. It was by turns exhilarating and exhausting. But what we were producing was so good and so far beyond anything I could ever have done on my own that I finally had to push my ego aside and give myself over to the process. But deep down, I was getting self-conscious because I realized that if I had been writing this on my own, I would have just been writing down all of those first thoughts, the ones Matt, for some reason, rejected. My internal editor would never toss out 3 or 4 or 5 ideas before settling on a 6th, but Matt's would and did. Was this why my writing progress had stalled out? Was I not being careful enough? Was I simply not holding myself to a high enough standard? What Matt and I were writing was good, even great. It felt undeniable. You may or may not be into a movie about terrorists taking over a passenger train, but there was no way you could say we weren't writing the living shit out of it. And maybe the best thing about it, the thing that really made it work, was that we weren't doing it cynically. As much as we wanted to sell it for $1 million, this was in no way a condescending money grab. We didn't think we were lowering ourselves or pulling off some kind of arch stunt. We honestly, truly loved Die Hard. And now we were having the time of our lives writing a script that had every bit of the energy and creativity of Die Hard, except it was all our own. We still had so much work ahead of us that we tried our best to focus on just that, the work, not the outcome. But even as we toiled away late into the night, scary questions haunted us. What if it doesn't sell? What if it's not as good as we think it is? What if we're wasting our time? What if we're writing something no one wants? As Dr. Klein brings Whitley Strieber's first hypnosis session to a close, he gives him an out. If he wants to stop, if the process is too emotionally difficult, he doesn't need to be a hero. The session has been brutal, and Whitley's fear very real. He wouldn't be the first person to simply turn away from whatever is happening and try as hard as they can to never think about it again. And after all, isn't that what the visitors want? Don't they want us to forget? But Whitley insists that he wants to continue. He doesn't want to, quote, walk out before the end of the movie. As his terror ebbs, it is replaced in degrees by blazing curiosity and a sense that he might be uniquely positioned to investigate the alien abduction phenomenon from the inside, if you will. His own conscious recall of the events of December 26th and now his hypnosis regarding October 4th has left him with a new sense of control he hasn't felt before and the beginnings of a plan. If and when the visitors come back, he'll be ready for them. And this time, he'll have some questions of his own. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join me next time for Communion, Part 2. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.